Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Later in the show today, we're going to talk about an alarming new study on the sharp decline in bird populations in North America in areas where they were once thriving. But first, we're going to discuss the latest developments in the so-called U.S.-Ukraine Minerals Agreement. On May 8th, the Ukrainian parliament ratified this minerals deal, which establishes, according to reports, a joint investment fund between Kyiv and Washington and grants the U.S. special access to projects developing Ukraine's natural resources. And Ukraine, of course, has large underground deposits of critical minerals, including lithium, graphite, cobalt, titanium, and rare earths like scandium, which are essential for an array of industries from defense to electric vehicles. But in a March article for Rolling Stone, today's guest Antonio Juhas notes that Ukraine also has a century-long history of extensive fossil fuel operations, and it also possesses substantial reserves of oil, gas, and coal. And prior to the 2022 invasion by Russia, Ukraine transited more gas than any other nation in the world via an expansive pipeline network that came in from Russia. And after Russia, Ukraine actually has Europe's largest gas storage capacity. So what do we need to know about the so-called minerals agreement? How can Ukraine use its vast natural resources to create a just and sustainable future for its people? And what is the significance of Ukraine's fossil fuel and mineral resources, both for the U.S. and Russia? Well, to help us unpack some of these questions and get some answers, we're so pleased to speak with Antonia again about the latest developments in the Ukraine-U.S. deal. Antonia Juhas is an award-winning investigative journalist focused on energy and climate policy. She's also the author of several books, including her most recent, Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. And you can also read Antonia's piece, Trump's Minerals Deal, A Fossil Fuel Shakedown, by going to kalw.org. You click on news and then Your Call, and then you can find the article in our resources section. So it's so good to have you back with us, Antonia. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ethan. It's great to be with you again.
So Antonia, just for listeners who haven't been following this or might have missed our previous show with you on this topic, can you give us background on the minerals deal? Why did Trump propose it, and what were the original terms?
Sure. So the idea for this deal actually originated with Zelensky and with Ukraine during the Biden administration. Zelensky was trying to encourage the Republican Congress to continue its interest in and support of Ukraine during the war. And the idea was that if there was an agreement signed between the U.S. and Ukraine to encourage development of Ukraine's natural resources, that would help tie the U.S. more and give a potential benefit to the Americans and tie the Americans to the Ukrainians. The deal was not signed during the Biden administration. Instead, negotiations of it moved over into the Trump administration, and then it took on an entirely different flavor and really became much more about a natural resource grab, control, and I would say really being a bargaining chip in Trump's realignment of the U.S. really away from Ukraine and towards Russia, towards Putin, and to create a deal that I would argue benefits really in the end probably Putin in the U.S. More than Ukraine. And listeners might recall the now sort of infamous meeting at the White House where Zelensky came to the White House at the end of February for a meeting with Trump. And this was televised. It was a made-for-TV moment. The original intention had been that this agreement would be signed then. Instead, what happened was Trump and J.D. Vance just went on the attack against Zelensky in what to me was clearly a demonstration, a public demonstration of this realignment of the U.S. towards Russia and away from Ukraine and an attempt to really put Zelensky in his place. Trump literally said, you don't have any cards. You know, you have to do what we say. And the deal was not signed. Many negotiations took place in the interim. Trump increasingly put forward policies that benefited Putin and benefited Russia, said publicly basically what Zelensky gets if he signs this deal is that the war will end. He sees it as a piece of the peace process, but he said what Zelensky gets is that Russia doesn't get all of Ukraine. That's, you know, sort of the thing that Zelensky gets out of the deal. Yeah.
And why does Trump think this is essentially a peace agreement? How in his mind, if we can read his mind, which I know is impossible, how would that lead to peace?
He sees it as part of the, I think, concession process. But the, you know, within that quote unquote concession process of if you're going to help negotiate a peace deal between Ukraine and Russia, each side is going to need to give something up, right? And I think he has viewed this as a benefit to Ukraine. One, initially, in the initial framework of the agreement, it was Trump framed it as a way that the U.S. was going to get its money back, the money that it had invested in the war, the money that it had given Ukraine for the war. And in exchange, Ukraine was going to get continued support from the United States and potential future U.S. investment in its minerals sector, and that that was a process towards a peace negotiation with Russia. Russia has so far made no concessions other than Trump saying, for example, Russia won't get all of Ukraine as a result of a peace negotiation, but Putin has not said that. Trump has said that. And the agreement was negotiated and it was signed on April 30th. And there have been some improvements, but the sort of basics of the deal are that the U.S. and Ukraine will set up a reconstruction fund. 50% of all of Ukraine's future profits from all of its natural resources, oil, gas, coal, as you had said at the outset, it does have known amounts of titanium and graphite. It might have lithium. It might have rare earth minerals. We don't know that for sure. The analysis that it might have rare earth minerals is based on a 50-year-old study from when Ukraine was part of the former Soviet Union. So there's sort of a hope and expectation that it might have these minerals that are used in renewable energy and other purposes. But that 50% of all the future profits from infrastructure, that could include pipelines, that could include refineries, that could include ports, future production of all of these natural resources would go into this fund, with the intent being that the money would be reinvested, or a portion of it would at least be reinvested within Ukraine. The U.S. would get preferential access to any future natural resource development in Ukraine. The U.S. would get 50% say over how the fund is spent. Any negotiation that Ukraine has with anyone over its natural resources, the U.S. gets to see those permits, those applications, those agreements. That means, for example, as you mentioned at the outset, that mass and critically important transit of Russian fossil fuels that currently travel through Ukraine, any future deals, the U.S. government would get to see that. And even more critical for Russia is that right now the terms that the Trump administration have sort of tentatively set out for any sort of peace negotiation between Ukraine and Russia would allow Russia to keep everything that it currently controls. Russia would keep Crimea, and Russia would keep the land and water that it has taken since 2022 from Ukraine, and it would get to maintain that. That's important because that includes Ukraine's known offshore gas fields, much of its onshore oil and gas fields, and much of its coal operations. That includes the Eastern Donbass region, which has significant industrial operations, and Russia would get to keep all of that. So that's a big bounty for Russia. And then if Trump and Putin stay as cozy as they are, there's certainly the concern that anything the U.S. government gets to see and be involved in through this reconstruction fund, Putin could potentially have his eyes on, and potential benefits or influence over those decisions as well.
We're speaking with Antonia Juhas, award-winning investigative journalist focused on energy and climate policy. And we're talking about the U.S.-Ukraine minerals agreement and some of the details of that piece. If you have questions for Antonia about what's in the agreement or what's going on with the latest negotiations between the U.S. and Ukraine, if you have thoughts about what Ukraine should be doing, we'd love to hear from you. The phone lines are open. You can dial in at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or if you'd rather email a question or a comment about what's happening in Ukraine and with these negotiations between the U.S. and Ukraine, then you can email us at yourcall@klw.org. Antonia, as we think about this agreement that was signed compared to that Oval Office blow up back in February, I've read some observers seem to think that Ukraine has been able to negotiate somewhat better terms for itself. Have you observed that Ukraine has been able to improve the deal somewhat, this final deal that is now being ratified by the Ukrainian parliament?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, basically, the deal that was first negotiated, which I was able to review for my March Rolling Stone article, negotiations actually got worse following the first release of the first draft, and the Trump administration asked for even greater concessions from the Ukrainians. And basically, what the Ukrainians have been able to do is walk back some of the even worse items that were put forward by the administration, and some of the worse conditions that were included in the draft that I analyzed, such as the initial drafts gave the U.S. majority control over all decision making, over all funds, basically majority control over this fund, and that was a big concession that now apparently it's going to be 50-50 control. The U.S. and the Ukrainians share 50-50 control. The also other big concession was that Trump had wanted all of the money that the United States has given to Ukraine in the years during the war to count towards the U.S. contribution to the fund. And that would essentially be Ukraine having to pay back, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, depending on how you calculate it. And that was removed. But what Ukraine did not get, which was really the central piece that Zelensky wanted from the beginning of what this deal would provide for him, was a guaranteed U.S. security guarantee that the United States would continue to provide some sort of future security to Ukraine in the ongoing war, or even in a peace with Russia. And that was not included. There is no, there is no security guarantee in this agreement. But there is that apparently more balanced, you know, oversight. I will say what this fund is unprecedented. There is no example of the U.S. doing this in the past. Generally, if we're involved in reconstruction in a country post-war, the U.S. gives grants or loans to that reconstruction effort. If the U.S. wants to invest in a country, it signs contracts like anyone else. I was, you know, looking for comparisons, and even, for example, in the U.S. occupation government of Iraq, when the U.S. was the occupying power in Iraq, there was no such agreement like this, and nothing that gave the U.S. this type of preferential treatment, preferential access, participation in decision-making over, for example, Iraq's natural resources. So this is not something that the U.S. normally does. It is, you know, extremely still extortionist, and the one benefit that Ukraine, you know, could get, which is a security guarantee, it doesn't get. The other benefit that it could get is that if foreign investment does come in, that 50% of the profits of that investment would ostensibly need to be reinvested in Ukraine, which is good. All of the money wouldn't necessarily leave Ukraine. But that's also 50% of its state-owned profits, which would have stayed in Ukraine anyway. So there's like some pieces that could potentially have a benefit down the line, but it's really, you know, extorting a deal out of Ukraine in a very weak position. And in my article, I interviewed Svetlana Romanko, among other experts. She's a environmental lawyer in Ukraine. And she had, you know, pointed out that one of the things that Ukrainians have wanted is help in development of the potential for these rare earths, minerals. And the reason is because they have been working hard to transition off of fossil fuels. And one reason is to remove the power that fossil fuels have in supplying Russia with its incredible advantage that it gets from being such a fossil fuel powerhouse. If the world, including Ukraine, reduces its dependence on fossil fuels, then it reduces the power of those fuels and reduces Russia's influence. And Ukraine has been trying to do that for some time. And also, there is deep concern about the worsening climate crisis and the environmental harms of producing fossil fuels. And so what Svetlana Romanko had told me was, we would like to see these investments happen in rare earths in Ukraine, but we would want to make sure that any investment is focused on renewable energy, is focused on a domestic use of those minerals. So not just the money, but the minerals. Mm-hmm. Nothing in this agreement provides for, never says renewable energy anywhere. There's no requirement that the minerals have to stay or any of the bounty of the production stays in Ukraine, only a portion of the funds. And there's certainly no provisions for environmental protection or labor standards or anything like that. And I will just add, we mm-hmm. only know a portion of what's in this agreement because the details, this sets up a limited partnership in Delaware, which is where the Reconstruction Fund will be housed. And all of the details of that limited partnership, which is significantly more information, has not been made public.
Well, that's why it's so important that we have journalists like you on this story, since there isn't that transparency that you normally expect. I want to let listeners know that this is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about the U.S.-Ukraine Minerals Agreement. We're joined by Antonia Juhas, award-winning investigative journalist. She serves on the National Press Club's COSIC Environmental Justice Grant Committee and developed the course Fossil Fuels and the Climate Crisis at Tulane University in New Orleans, and her piece Trump's Minerals Deal, A Fossil Fuel Shakedown. You can read that by going to kalw.org, clicking on News and Your Call, and then looking for the article in our resources section. Also want to let listeners know, if you have questions about this agreement, if you are concerned about U.S. foreign policy with respect to Ukraine, if you have questions about the Trump-Putin relationship and how that is affecting this Ukraine negotiations, that number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Antonia, you were just talking about the fossil fuel dimension of this. And of course, it's called the Minerals Agreement, but it feels like hydrocarbons are a big part of what is going on here, that there's an oil and gas play that maybe not at first at issue so much when it was originally drafted, as you mentioned, proposed by the Biden administration. Can you talk about whether this feels like more like an oil and gas agreement than a minerals deal?
Yeah, to me, it's an oil and gas agreement that really has a lot more to do with Russia than it has to do with anybody else. And I think that has to do with the two pieces, which is Russia, at a minimum, getting to control these areas of Ukraine that it's taken since the 2014 invasion and then the 2022 invasion. And that's a real bounty for Russia. And then, you know, in looking at what Trump has been clear about is that he wants to make the United States a partner with Russia and Saudi Arabia and to model the U.S. as a fossil-fueled autocracy just like those other regimes, and to ensure that fossil fuels remain dominant moving forward. And that is good for parts, that's good for the fossil fuel industry, certainly. It's very good for the Russian economy. It's very good for the Saudi economy, for the world to remain hooked on fossil fuels. In response to the 22 invasion, Russian invasion of Ukraine, the world really got behind this call from coming from Ukrainians, which was to end the war, end fossil fuel dependence. The European Union actually announced this month that it intends to fully end its imports of all energy products from Russia by 2027, oil, gas, coal, nuclear, you name it. And that's a continuation of an agenda that was set in place following the invasion. The Trump administration is diametrically opposed to that agenda. It supports Russia and the Saudis in ending an agenda that transitions off of fossil fuels. And even more than that, Trump has already set in place the process for ending U.S. sanctions against Russia. And those sanctions have been extremely influential in reducing Russia's overall income as part of this global effort. Russia's income from its fossil fuel exports are half today of what they were in 2022. Trump is in the process of negotiating a potential lifting of those sanctions, which would be fantastic for Russia. It would also reopen up Russia to U.S. oil companies that are very eager to get back into Russia, chief among them ExxonMobil, and give them once again access to Russia's vast oil riches. So to me, this agreement and the quote-unquote peace process for Trump is all about what's best for Putin, what's best for Saudi Arabia, which is where he's headed tomorrow, and what's best for those who care about maintaining fossil fuel dominance.
We have a caller who just took a question in off the air and asked, what has been the reaction from Europe, France, Germany, et cetera, about this Ukraine minerals agreement with Trump?
Yeah, the biggest concern for the Europeans is that Ukraine is trying to gain membership into the European Union. And this whole, the United States gets preferential treatment, gets preferential access, gets to see every single agreement. I worried the Europeans for lots of reasons, one of which being, was it going to make it impossible for Ukraine to become a member of the European Union? That is, again, thank you for asking that question to the caller. That is also a concession that the administration made, which was the agreement specifically says, if anything in this agreement conflicts with Ukraine joining the European Union, that can be renegotiated. The Europeans have been trying to step in where the U.S. is falling back. And as I said, implementing these new, announcing these new stronger sanctions against Russia as the U.S. might be reducing or eliminating its own sanctions, stepping up in potential funding to Ukraine, support for Ukraine, and really trying to help push the U.S. to negotiate a much greater good faith between the U.K., between Ukraine and Russia, rather than continuing its the U.S.'s increasingly favoritism towards Putin.
And Antonio, you've talked about how Trump is really moving to align the U.S. with Russia. Can you give us the specifics of how this deal, this minerals agreement, would help Russia sell more oil ultimately?
Yeah, well, first it would be gaining that access to Ukraine's resources, and gaining, in general, when one country gains access to resources of another, it's not just that Putin gets access to more oil and gas and coal. It's that he denies the power of those resources to Ukraine by Russia getting them. Also, this critical, you know, one of the reasons why the 2022 Russia invaded Ukraine in the first place was that Russia has been trying to bypass Ukraine and open up a pipeline to carry its gas instead of through Ukraine and out to Europe, straight to Europe under the Baltic Sea. It's called the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. That got blocked by the Germans as Russia was leading into its invasion of Ukraine and became a tool in the back and forth between those trying to stop Russia from invading Ukraine and Russia's desire to invade Ukraine. Russia was trying to stop Ukraine from playing its role in blocking the movement of its gas through the country. What Russia would get is, again, if the U.S. remains allied with Russia, any time the Ukrainians sign any deal about the movement of gas in their country, around their country, Russia would get to see that negotiation, and that could be deeply problematic for Ukraine and a great advantage for the Russians. Trump has also, or sorry, the U.S. government has also indicated its interest in restarting that pipeline, Nord Stream 2, which would really help Russia a lot and could very much hurt the Ukrainians.
And Antonia, we're almost out of time, but I have a couple more questions for you. First, just what options does Ukraine have at this point? It seems like the U.S. signaling that it's aligning now with Russia over Ukraine. Ukraine has been trying to backfill the military support that the U.S. was giving with more assistance from the EU. Is Ukraine pivoting, trying to pivot away from the U.S., and what are the prospects for that being successful?
I mean, certainly Zelensky has been, you know, from the beginning, trying to maintain this close relationship with Europe and the U.S., obviously had a much greater ally in the Biden administration than it does in the Trump administration. And so Zelensky has definitely been trying to pivot and has found welcome support in the EU. But that support just doesn't carry the same capacity, basically, as the U.S. potentially could or has in the past. And also, if the U.S. continues to fully align with Russia, it puts Ukraine in an incredibly weak position. And we already saw that play out just in the last few days. Zelensky had said that he wouldn't wouldn't have the Ukrainians meet with the Russians this week unless Russia agreed to a ceasefire starting today. Trump stepped in and said, well, why don't you go ahead and meet on Thursday? And now Zelensky himself and potentially Putin are going to meet on Thursday, but there's no ceasefire between now and then. And again, Putin continuously refuses to state any concession that he's willing to make in any peace negotiations. So the idea that something new would get negotiated on Thursday, there's certainly a hope that there could be, but you know, we've seen this play out over and over again, that Zelensky you know, shows up to have a negotiation, or members of the Ukrainian government do, and Putin continues to hold a firm line, which is zero concessions. So, you know, Zelensky is very much between a rock and a hard place, and certainly all those that want peace are facing very difficult circumstances, and that has gotten much, much more difficult with Trump's alignment with Putin.
Mm-hmm. So Thursday, we'll see if anything comes out of that. Any other next steps that you're looking to in terms of this U.S.-Ukraine minerals agreement, and any other stories that you've got in the pipeline that you want to preview here?
Well, I think, you know, it's really important to see how this agreement plays out and what the details are. There shouldn't be a model being put forward by this administration of this type of natural resource capture and extortion of a country that is trying to get U.S. support. You know, this agreement should not become a model. It needs to be watched closely, and it needs to be watched as the details become more clear to see how much control the U.S. actually exercises and what benefit, if any, the Ukrainians will get from signing such an agreement.
Yeah, well, I think it just underscores once again how important it is to have a journalist like you following this story. Just want to thank you for joining us and explaining what's in this agreement and why it's so important. Antonia Juhas, award-winning investigative journalist, author of several books, including her most recent, Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill, and her piece, Trump's Minerals Deal, A Fossil Fuel Shakedown, is available on our Your Call website at kalw.org. Antonia, thank you so much for joining us on Your Call's One Planet series.
Thanks for having me, Ethan. Great to be with you.
And coming up next, we're going to talk about a groundbreaking new study that's showing a disturbing trend of North American bird populations in severe decline, especially in places where they used to be thriving. We'll talk about that on Your Calls One Planet series coming up after this short break. Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. We're podcasting the show. You can find out more information on our website via kalw.org, where you can also listen to our past shows and sign up for our newsletter so you always find out what's coming up next and never miss a show. And if you have any show ideas for us, drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. Well, now we're going to switch gears and talk about a groundbreaking new study that reveals a very disturbing trend. North American bird populations are declining fastest in the very places where they should be thriving: protected areas, national parks, and even suburbs designed to support wildlife. Researchers have used 14 years of community science data from eBird to track population changes across the ranges of 495 bird species throughout North and Central America and the Caribbean. Now, May 10th was the World Migratory Bird Day in Canada and the U.S. So what can we do to protect birds and their habitats? To talk more about the study, why this is all happening, and what can be done to create healthy and thriving places for birds, we're very pleased to be joined by Amanda Rodewald. She is the Garvin Professor and Director of Conservation Science at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, and also in the Department of Natural Resources at Cornell University, one of the lead authors of this recent study called North American Bird Declines Are Greatest, Where Species Are Most Abundant. Welcome to Your Calls One Planet series, Amanda.
Oh, thank you, Ethan. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Amanda, over the years, there have been many studies about the alarming decline in bird populations, but the patterns that are uncovered here are really startling. They're declining, as I said, most rapidly where birds were once most abundant. So can you talk to us more about the genesis of this study and what the key findings are?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you say, over the last few years, we have seen these reports that have come out that have really alerted us to these widespread and oftentimes really steep declines in North American birds. And so what we do here is we leverage eBird data, so from this global participatory science project, to really unpack precisely where it is we're seeing those declines, you know, within regions and within landscapes. And so it's really telling that we see that while, yes, 75% of the almost 500 species that we analyzed are declining across the whole range, we find that for almost every single species, there are areas of increase and decrease. And yeah, the most severe declines that they're experiencing are in areas that were their strongholds, these areas where they were most abundant. And that means that places where we'd expect them to thrive, their numbers are really tanking in some cases. And there are a variety of reasons why we might see this. But overall, what it does suggest is that environmental conditions are deteriorating. And that's important for birds, of course. But I think it's really urgent that we remember that we share the same environments as birds. We've heard of the term, right, canary in the coal mine. And so if birds aren't, if environments aren't healthy enough to support bird populations, well, I think it's not a big stretch to say that they're unlikely to be healthy enough to support people as well.
It's very alarming and disturbing to think that this could be an indication of the health of our own environment, as you noted. Let's talk about the data that you relied on. I understand eBird is an online database of bird observations. Can you talk about where the data came from and how you were able to put it to use?
Yeah, definitely. So eBird is a just incredible project. It's a global participatory science project that's led by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, but fundamentally, it's a partnership around the world with different bird organizations and communities and individual birders. And so volunteers submit their observations and checklists to a central database that we keep at the lab. And just since 2002, when eBird was launched, we now have reached almost 2 billion observations that have been submitted by nearly 1 million eBirders, representing every country on the planet. And these data are just profoundly important. They give us a new and sharper lens to understand what's happening to bird population and, by association, what's happening to environmental conditions. And so the data we're using here are, for the first time ever, able to estimate the population change, or what we call the trend, of these bird populations at a landscape scale, so about 17 by 17 mile area. And why that's such a game changer is that's at a scale that, at which we make decisions. And also, it allows us to detect declines before they become so widespread and severe that we can only de that we finally are able to detect them at state or country or continental scales. And so that early detection ability is really a game changer.
Well, it's pretty remarkable how you're essentially able to crowdsource all this data using internet and online access. But then, how do you go about verifying the accuracy of the information you're getting from the eBird database? How do you make sure that the trends that you're seeing are reliable?
Oh, yes, super good question. And so we use a variety of different approaches. And so some of those approaches rely really working with the observers as they're submitting those records. So we have filters that are going to catch unusual species or unusual numbers that are being reported. And so those first are kind of, they ping the observer, they can double check or provide additional information to support those observations. We have a group of really wonderful regional experts who generously donate their time to review those records and verify them. And then here at the Cornell Lab, we use a variety of statistical approaches where we're able to really make sure those data are both accurate and rigorously analyzed to account for differences in things like effort, the number of individuals who are going out with birders, how much time they're spending, what was the weather, and which might affect our ability to detect birds, and what time of day were they out there. And so those kinds of approaches make this information both reliable and really sound, to the point that I would say that these data are now being used by governments, by conservation organization, by all sorts of management groups to make decisions. And that includes here at home, even the US Fish and Wildlife Service, right? And so I think it says a lot when these agencies, who are even subject to litigation, have the confidence to rely on the data. It's really some innovative approaches we've used to address some of the challenges that one typically encounters with community science projects.
Well, it's wonderful to hear about the access to the data that not just researchers like yourself, but as you said, government agencies are able to utilize, and the public ultimately is able to get a better picture of what's happening out there. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Amanda Rodewald Garvin, Professor and Director of Conservation Science at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology and in the Department of Natural Resources at Cornell University. Amanda was one of the lead authors of a recent study showing North American bird population declines, particularly where the species used to be the most abundant, or may be the most abundant, but still showing major declines. And I want to open the phone lines now. If you are a birder and want to call to describe your experiences, what you've seen observing birds where you live or recreate, if you've noticed changes in the bird life, bird populations where you live, what questions do you have about how to support bird populations? The number to call to join the conversation, 866-798 Talk. That's 866-798-8255, or send us an email to yourcall at KALW.org. Amanda, I wanted to dig a little deeper into the findings from the study. Now, you talked about the study showed that although 75% of species were declining, 97% showed separate areas of significantly increasing and decreasing populations, and they tended to decline most, and as we've talked about, in those strongholds where species were most abundant. Can you talk about which specific areas in North America have been showing this pattern?
Yeah, and that's one of the really sobering elements that we see with this report, which is consistent with what others have also shown, in that we're seeing declines across every type of habitat in the U.S. So whether it's forests or wetlands, you know, arid lands or the chaparral habitat, grasslands, and so kind of you name it, we're seeing many species are in a state of decline. So grassland birds and shorebirds are really the ones that are in the most trouble as a whole. And that is, you know, oftentimes because we still are facing, you know, pretty high levels of land conversion. So even in the central U.S., we are still losing 1 to 2 million acres of grasslands every year, for example. Shorebirds, many of the species, and including right around the San Francisco area, you know, where some of your listeners might be tuning in from, you know, shorebirds rely on areas to stop over and rest and refuel along coastal areas, or even places like the Central Valley, you know, flooded fields and areas there. And we're seeing around the country and in California specifically that many of those stopover locations are seeing big declines in shorebirds. And so there, again, we have this alignment too, because we know a lot of coastal communities are facing challenges from extreme weather and sea level rise, you know, loss of wetlands that were, you know, really important to keeping those systems productive and healthy. Those are factors that are affecting not only bird populations, like the shorebirds I mentioned, but also the human populations that are living in these areas. And that's why it's really a win-win when we start investing in bird conservation. We benefit from those same actions.
Well, we do have a local caller joining us, Alan in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Calls One Planet series, Alan.
Oh, good morning. I started bird watching mostly in San Francisco in the 70s. So I've been doing it a long time, and it's gotten so depressing to go out. I hardly go out anymore. I have got something to say about eBird and that I don't use it. There was a rare bird found in a marsh near us, and so lots and lots of people were going out to see the rare bird. And this is a place that I know well. I've been following for 30 years, and so I know every bird there. And then I would read people's eBird accounts, and they were just shabby. People went out to see the rare bird, but they didn't bother to count all the Western gulls, and they couldn't tell a Western sandpiper from a least sandpiper and all sorts of things like that. So I have a little trouble with some eBird. I know there are people who are really dedicated and good at it, but I don't know. It's not for me.
Great point, Alan. I first of all, I just appreciate you weighing in with your experiences, but also your question or comment about eBird. And I wanted to give Amanda a chance just to respond to that. What do you make of Alan's observation that eBird may not always have the most reliable or well documented data on it?
Right. So I think it's a, you know, and thanks, Alan, for calling in and for your sharing your experience as well. So I think it's important to distinguish, too, between when we're talking about eBird data and that database, there are different types of data that we rely on to produce the science or really to support decisions. And so people have the option to submit just observations of birds, for example, single kind of one-off, not complete surveys of what people are seeing. And there are also the other option, the one that we use for data analysis, and that's used by, you know, in many analyses around the world by others, is what we call complete checklists. And that's where people submit all the a checklist of every species that they've seen or heard. And so then by association, we know which species aren't there. And so those checklists provide much more valuable information. So I guess I would say, number one, we only use complete checklists in our observations. We also are, we have the ability to now statistically model sort of observer skill for a given area, for you know, regions, and for individuals, although it's anonymized, so we don't know specific individuals. It doesn't work quite like that. So no fear birders, and also no really ability to kind of compete with your birder friends, you know, on either side of those. But that also means we can sort of filter the data and only use those checklists that are from participants who are very competent. Right, who we have a high degree of confidence in the reports that they're submitting. And then there are other statistical approaches. Mm-hmm. But Alan, what you describe is exactly why there are so many. One cannot just go into eBird, take out every observation that's been submitted, and just, yeah, think that, well, we can use this to tell us what's happening with birds. It really requires this broader community, some sophisticated and innovative approaches to statistics and computational ecology. So yeah, so what you observe, definitely that's what you see when you would look at the raw data, everything that might be submitted. So you could think of that as kind of more on the birder side tool of things, where you can just get a sense of what's happening in the field at the moment.
Well, I appreciate, Amanda, you clarifying how eBird works and how the academic researchers like yourself are using it. Let's go back to the phones. We have Joan calling in from Oakland. Joan, welcome to Your Calls One Planet series.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is, do you have any data on which trees are most beneficial for birds here in the East Bay? And if so, besides the coast live oak, can you recommend a few trees, please?
Yeah, thank you, Joan. Amanda, I don't know if you're expert on native plants and birds, at least in the San Francisco Bay Area, but if you could comment on that, or just more broadly, how plants relate to the bird life.
Yeah, and that's a great question. And I mean, you're right on that it really does make a difference which species are available to birds as they're moving through. And so native plants, as a general rule, you know, those are going to offer the best resources to birds as they're moving through an area. Things like oaks are known, I think, across the country, right? For especially an oak at bud break, you know, has a lot of insects usually at the top. Those are great places to find migratory birds. I think for regional suggestions, probably some of the best groups to connect with are like local Audubon groups and birding clubs, who may be able to have and really give you advice on the specifics in that area. Fortunately, I'm calling in from Ithaca, New York today, and so I'm less authoritative to tell you specifically which species. But I bet if you start Googling in the region with those local organizations, you'll find a wealth of information. But yeah, native plants are generally the best choice to make in terms of landscaping.
And we did a whole show actually on native plants and insects, which are the, at least as I understood it from that show, one of the main sources of food for birds. So there's that whole food chain there. Well, we're almost out of time, but I want to go to one more caller. We have Peter dialing in from Florida. Peter, welcome to Your Calls One Planet series.
Hi. Yeah, you just mentioned insects. And you also you mentioned innovative approaches, because this is what occurred to me, is a lot of what you're talking about, like citizen observation, is what they're doing with the Xerces Society with regard to monarch butterfly, because, you know, they're suffering such a decline of population. And I was just wondering, talk about innovative approaches, is there any chance of the Xerces Society or the Lab of Ornithology, like, sharing data that these other people are making observations about the monarch butterfly migrations? Is there any chance of you holding hands and sharing information, innovative approach, maybe for whatever reason? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, thank you, Peter. Amanda, response.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. And you know, it's so important, and Xerces Society and others who are focused on conservation of insects, and especially pollinators, as we know, are just declining globally, including in North America. That's really important. So we do share data and we do, you know, work with other groups. So eBird data, open access, anyone is, you know, is very welcome to use these approaches. And certainly a lot of the researchers and statisticians who are developing these different methods are sharing those results and innovations through journal articles and professional conferences and such. With INSECTS in particular, I'll just say that we have a recent project that we completed that is in partnership too with the Cornell Atkinson for sustainability here at the lab of, or here at Cornell University, where we were using some eBird data in combination with land use land cover data to improve our estimates of wild bee numbers and how many species we might see at a place. Because, you know, perhaps as you know, Peter, you know, by way of your question, it's, you know, there aren't a lot of data on bees and some other insect groups because they're so much more difficult to survey than birds. So birds may actually help to provide a sort of window into the view of what's happening with some of these other insect populations, or at least to point to areas that warrant additional investigation and monitoring.
Yeah. So we're just almost out of time, Amanda, but I just wanted to just ask and get a brief response from you. What's next in your research and how can listeners get involved or find out more?
Yeah, I think for us, you know, we continue to better try to refine are the information that we have available to support decisions. And I think one of the things that I'm most, you know, excited and, you know, I guess have hope about is that more and more we see that there's such alignment between the actions that we need to take to conserve bird populations and the same actions we need to take to support human health and well-being. And so we're seeing it's not a question so much of, right, do we take care of birds or do we take care of people? It's really more about how do we best serve the needs of both. And we now, thanks to participants in eBird and other community science projects, we have more information than ever. And knowledge is power. And so, you know, that's what we're trying to really help those who are out on the ground doing conservation to make more strategic, proactive, and effective decisions about where we're placing our resources.
Well, thank you for the work that you're doing and for explaining it to our listeners. Amanda Rodewald, Garvin Professor and Director of Conservation Science at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology and Department of Natural Resources at Cornell University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ethan.
And that is our show. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. You can listen to our past shows or sign up for our podcast on our webpage at kalw.org. Email any show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, and it's Your Call.